Ted's a nephew of mine, but I don't want that held against him. Some other details here before we start. It costs $8. Everybody knows, I think, about that. And we are pleased to have with us Shaw TV, University of Lethbridge, Lethbridge Herald, Erickson's Restaurant. These people all help us out with this thing. Way we handle this, the speaker will talk for about 25 or 30 minutes, and we'll have lunch, and then we'll have a question period for about half an hour. Now, I'll introduce Ted. He has quite a background. He's been through university a couple of times, and spent 2 years in Burma working for the World University Service of Canada on dairy genetic improvement. He was in the employ of the Government of Canada at that time, and so he needed the international experience and got it that way. So, what else do we know? I think that's about it. Ted, I think you're on.
Thank you, Uncle Ann, and any association between you and me always helps me. So, no question about that at all. It's a pleasure to be back speaking to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. It's been a few years since I was last here, and there have been, no question, many changes. To recollection, I think this is the third time that I've spoken to this group, and it is always a pleasure. The organization that I work with now is called Canada Beef Export Federation. It was formed in 1989 as an industry association, a non-profit association, with a singular mandate to identify and develop international markets for Canadian beef. At that time, the cattle industry came together to form this organization, along with support from government, because we had begun to increase our production side of our industry, and in the previous decade we'd seen a decline in beef processing capacity. Right about that time, we had successfully defended ourselves against a number of countervailing duty actions that the U.S. attempted to mount against movement of live cattle to the United States, and as well the prospect of anti-dumping action or even legislation, country of origin labeling, that would require all beef to show its original country at retail in the United States were around. Bottom line is we were very dependent on exports to the United States. Over 95% of our exports were to that market, and it was a vulnerability that we wished to get out ahead of and address through growth in other markets. In the following 12 years, the model worked and worked well. In 1990, Canada exported only $24 million worth of Canadian beef products to Asia and Mexico, the regions that were targeted for growth. And I should say the targeting process was fairly easy. Where do we have access and who has money to pay? Those are the two pieces of magic that really do define where our opportunities lie. Other than that, issues of preference for beef can all be addressed in the market itself. But $24 million is not much for, at that time, a $5 billion industry. We weren't participating in international markets in any way. By 2002, just prior to BSE, our exports to Asia and Mexico had increased to $500 million, and that was approximately 30%, just over 30% of our total exports were to Asia and Mexico. Anytime you've been able to generate a year-over-year 28% increase in growth to the markets that you target over a 12-year period shows that some things are working. Our basic strategy was in each case to open a representative office so that in the market there is a place where sellers from Canada can come to meet qualified buyers, to understand the market, to be able to find out clients or identify clients whose needs roughly match with their own company's capabilities. And quite frankly, early on, that was primarily small and medium-sized Canadian packers. What we found with the arrival of Cargill, that same process was still valuable. And that's because Cargill is a sales organization when it comes to beef. But market development is not something that salesmen do well. Finding that next customer who wants to buy Canadian beef versus selling an extra container to the customers you already have is something that Canada Beef Export Federation and our industry did with that company and later IBP and Tyson in a way that they are not well suited to do. Their interest is in selling the products they have to sell. Our interest is to ensure that their focus is on selling Canadian beef. So today, the Canada Beef Export Federation operates offices in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, as well as Mexico. Our collective membership of about 60 members represents over 90% of the federally inspected or export-ready beef processing capacity, as well as provincial cattle producer organizations from Quebec through British Columbia, and provincial governments from Ontario through British Columbia. So there is excellent input to our strategy. We are able to focus the resources and intentions of those industry sectors and governments, again, on that singular focus of identifying and developing international markets. The BSE crisis in Canada, I don't have to tell this group, has caused some very, very significant challenges to our industry, and there are new challenges stemming from that still ahead of us. It still is quite amazing to the world that Canadian consumers maintain confidence and continue to maintain confidence in our products after BSE, and that we never did suffer a decline. In fact, sympathies of consumers across Canada to our industry resulted in an increase in consumptions during the first few months after BSE. And I think, as I recall, $15 a kilo tenderloins didn't hurt that consumption either. We had some real sales going on during that time. But consumption went up. Consumption has since come back down to roughly the same kind of level as pre-BSE, which means from a consumer's perspective, the world is normal for beef, which is not typical in the world of BSE. With perseverance on the industry side, our cattle numbers have actually increased. January 1, 2006, our total cattle population went for the first time over 15 million cattle. In part, that's not selling older cows into a depressed market for cull animals, but in part, that's also a commitment to future production. And in fact, this year, our industry will produce about 1.6 million tons of beef, and our industry's beef processing capacity has increased with the capability of processing all of that product in Canada if economics dictate that these cattle stay home. On a broad perspective, Canadian beef has been welcomed back to the majority of world markets. As a base, in 2002, Canada exported, prior to BSE, beef to 66 markets around the world. The vast majority of that was to the United States, Japan, Korea, and Mexico. Those four were absolutely, they accounted for 90% of our sales, over 90% of our sales. As comparison, Canada exported beef to 76 markets last year, 10 more than pre-BSE. But the pattern of sales has switched. We are, because we don't have access to Japan, and effective access to Japan, and we have no access to South Korea or to Taiwan, and restricted access to Mexico, our industry sought out more markets within which to do smaller sales. At this time, effectively, 84 markets are open to Canadian beef. 67 of those markets accept all edible Canadian beef products derived from all ages of animals. 16 markets accept beef derived only from animals under 30 months of age. One country, Japan, has further restricted that to only take beef derived from animals under 21 months of age. And four markets, key markets for Canadian beef, remain closed. In comparing our market recovery and our access success as compared to the United States, it's clear that the United States has moved faster. Currently, the United States has access to 35 markets around the world that Canada does not have access to, and that includes the very important Asian markets of South Korea and Taiwan. On the other side, Canada currently has access to 3 markets that the United States does not have access to, one of those being New Zealand, which we established trade by going through a risk assessment process. The only reason the U.S. doesn't have access to that market is because they've chosen not to go through that risk assessment process. It's not a market that we send any product to, but in Asia, New Zealand is looked at as one of the most competent regulators, and they making the decision to normalize trade with Canadian beef took away many of the arguments of other Asian regulators that they could not do so. Further, New Zealand took the step to normalize trade with Canadian beef, taking in boneless beef, bone-in beef, offal products from animals under and over the age of 30 months, while maintaining access to all of their worldwide export markets. Quite frankly, taking the wind out of the primary excuse of our friends just to the south, who have always said they're not prepared to jeopardize their ability to export to Asia. And even Mexico has, in our absence, developed a certain degree of trade to Asia, and they've brought that up as well. We have to be careful bringing Canadian beef back into our market because we could jeopardize our ability to trade in Asia. Well, New Zealand took that argument away. They've not lost access to any market, and they have normalized trade. In 2005, the last full year, Canada exported $1.9 billion worth of beef, or 458,000 tons, with 371,000 tons going to the United States and 73,000 tons going to markets outside the United States, about $140 million. From January to August this year, those exports have totaled 245,000 tons, or $882 million, of which 37,000 tons have gone to Asia and Mexico. This level of export has been reached in the absence of having South Korea, Taiwan, mainland China, and having unreasonable restrictions in Japan. While we are returning to international markets, in fact, some of the markets and our place in those markets have changed. Some of them are because of regulatory restrictions, where we're only able to bring in a very restricted range of products, or from only certain ages of cattle. And in other cases, markets have changed because our competitors have been given the golden opportunity of this generation to establish huge market shares with an incredible profitable environment and have built solid customer base that is causing us to re-break into markets and push them off of very strong positions. Australia and New Zealand have increased their exports significantly to Asia. Countries such as Mexico and even Uruguay have re-established trade or established for the first time trade with Asia simply because Asian markets are so short of product. They had to find alternate suppliers. It is a new competitive environment. We wanted to find out what meat buyers today and what meat sellers today in our key priority markets were looking for. What quality attributes have shifted? What has changed? What is our competitive advantage? How can we differentiate or place our product and our industry in such a way that we can address this new competition better than the old position that we enjoyed prior to BSE? To find the answers, the industry commissioned end-user surveys with major retail and food service buyers and meat managers in the United States and our key Asian and Mexico markets. About 1,000 in-person interviews total. They didn't know who the questions were being asked on behalf of. They didn't know it was Canada. Quite frankly, many assumed it was Australia and New Zealand, trying to figure out exactly how they should adjust and tweak their promotion programs to do even better than they are today and to build a stronger defense for our eventual arrival. But they did not know who was asking the question. Approximately half came from retail and half from food service. In this series of interviews, we asked them about the key buying characteristics that they find most useful or most valuable. We asked them about marbling standards, meat color, fat color, meat texture as being key components of the product itself, And we also asked them about what major criteria they use to make the decision of where to buy their beef from. The first question was on marbling, intramuscular fat, the streaks of fat within the muscle. We asked them about the standards used in Canada and the United States because we use the same standards. 73% of our retail and food service clients said that the marbling standards used in the grading systems in North America do meet their needs. If they want higher marbling or fat content, they order prime, less than that, choice or AAA, less again, AA, less again, single A. They were very satisfied with the marbling criteria used by Canada and the United States. Therefore, we do believe that that part of our grading system is acceptable, and it's actually a point of positive differentiation, not with the United States, but differentiation from Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, and others who don't have those same divisions of quality along fat content or marbling standards. We asked our clients about meat color and quality as well, and whether they ever received dark cutting or dark purplish meat. Animals that are primarily are stressed prior to processing, their meat builds an acid level, lactic acid level, that doesn't allow that meat to bloom bright red on the retail shelf. It stays a dark purplish color, and as the low acid meat from non-stressed animals becomes brighter and brighter red, the dark cutter product just gets darker and darker. It doesn't change eating quality, but it has a fundamental impact on eye appeal. Dark cutting beef is virtually not saleable in retail. We asked them about whether they had a problem in the last 2 years in purchasing dark cutting beef, and over 50%, 52% of our retail and food service clients said yes, they'd had that problem. And again, we asked what percentage who would never want to have a dark cutting product in their establishment. Again, not surprising, 92% of the respondents said they did not want dark cutting product in their establishments. Unlike the United States, our Canadian grading system does not allow dark cutting beef in any of our high quality grades. If a product will otherwise grade in our high quality grades but is dark cutting, it's removed and put into the B grades and never sees light of day in high quality programs. In the United States, dark cutters are half grade downgraded, and black cutters are full grade downgraded. You'll go from prime to choice, or choice to select, or even from high choice to low choice, but still being choice if it's dark cutters. That's a positive point of differentiation. That problem is not part of our grading system. We asked our international clients whether they've ever experienced problems associated with receiving beef that had yellow fat. White fat, again, has high eye appeal to consumers at retail. It doesn't affect eating quality, but does affect consumers' visual or opinion of quality. 53% of our international clients said that they received beef with yellow fat. 86% said they'd never want to receive beef with yellow fat again. Similarly, Canada's high quality grade specifically excludes beef with yellow fat, allowing only white fat or fat slightly tinged with amber, which fully meets their white fat needs. The United States has no quality criteria for fat color whatsoever. We asked whether our international clients have ever had consumer complaints associated with meat texture. Meat texture is a difference between a steak sitting on a retail counter and it sits up nice and flat and flush. That's a firm texture. Slightly soft soft texture is the official term, but it's meat that cups. That once it's cut and it sits on retail, it'll slide off the fat and it'll actually fall off of itself. It'll collapse in on itself. It is directly associated with eating quality because the final cook quality is not as good if the meat isn't firm to start with. Again, we asked if they'd had customer complaints. 55% said that they have had customer complaints with off-textured meat, and 89% said they would prefer never to have off-textured meat in their businesses. Canada removes all off-textured product from our high-quality grades, while the United States will allow partial downgrades for off-textured product. In total, we asked our international customers where the grading standards to deliver all of their high-quality attributes of marbling, of meat color, of meat texture, of fat color, would give them a competitive advantage in their marketplace, and whether they could charge a slight premium for that product versus any other grading system or program that would allow occasional off-quality product. The clear answer was overwhelming. 95% of our international clients have said, yes, if they can get a product that guaranteed to have those high-quality attributes, that's what they would buy from because they can make more money with it. These are the attributes that are delivered by our grading system and by our industry, and these are the grading attributes and the quality attributes of our products that our industry is now focusing on. We don't go out of the way to say that anybody is worse than us, but there is a pride and there is a market impact on saying what we are. We exclude quality attribute problems from our high quality grades, and many of our competitors don't. If you want the best of the best, Canada is the place to get it, and that's what we're promoting on. Using a positive points of differentiation strategy does capture the attention of competitors. And we've had two markets already where the U.S. Embassy has made official complaints to the Canadian Embassy. Those complaints were then transferred by the Canadian Embassies to Ottawa, and we were contacted. Luckily, the Government of Canada sees it the same way we do. We were contacted and congratulated for a good marketing program. So we are continuing to focus on those positive aspects that derive value for our products and derive value for our customers. I want to spend just a minute talking about value. Why these international markets? Why are they important? They're twofold. First off, Asia and Mexico value certain cuts and many cuts off the carcass which do not have value here in Canada. It's not just offal products, which are well known. We can sell tripe and intestine and organ meats in Asia and in Mexico more readily than we can in Canada. And in fact, when those markets are open for liver and for kidney and for heart and for tongue, for lip meat and cheek meat, tripe, when those international markets are open, there is a functioning market in Canada. Because they will take the product, and the domestic buyers have to compete with the world to keep some of it back at home for the relatively small trade that exists in Canada. But when those international markets are not open for those products, there is no market in Canada. We produce far, far more of those products than will ever be consumed in the foreseeable future in this market, and the market collapses. Our domestic clients, when international markets are not open for these products, must compete against rendering. And quite frankly, rendering is a negative value. It costs to render product. It's a virtual free product unless we can export it. That adds significant value to the overall animal, over $100 per head, potential. Many other actual meat cuts also have higher value in markets internationally than at home. Whether it's the meat between the ribs called intercostal, which is used in Korean-style barbecue, both in Korea and in Japan, or whether it's the muscular pillar of the diaphragm called the outside skirt, which is kind of like flank steak, except long and thin in its structure, sells for very specific premiums in Mexico. Chuck, the shoulder cuts, when Asia is open or Mexico is open, drive prices up in Canada because we can clear all volumes without those international markets. There's an imbalance in supply, and the value that we extract out of the domestic market goes down. In fact, in total, with access to international markets similar to what we had before BSC, those markets have the potential to add over $300 per carcass in additional value. And it is that export premium that drove our exports from $24 million in 1990 to $500 million in 2002. And it is that potential value that keeps us focused on regaining market access and regaining that premium that will make processing beef in Canada as value as it was before. Disturbingly, We've seen a decline in beef processing volumes in the last 2 years, and in fact, our beef processing industry is running at just over 60% of capacity utilization this year. We processed 3.5 million cattle in 2002. This year, we'll be lucky if we get to 3.3. It very well could be processing something in the area of 3.1 million cattle in whole year 2006. The economics of running packing plants at less than 70% capacity utilization is loss. That's the only way to put it. If you've got the capital expenditure and you've got the labor load and you've got all of your other fixed and variable costs, you cannot run these plants less than 70% and make money. It's not a structure that we really are enjoying this year. But why? Why are they running at such low levels after increasing capacity over the last 2 years? Well, there's a couple of economic things that are happening in Alberta. A lot of our capacity is in Western Canada. And availability of labor is a problem. Cost of labor is also a problem. With the increasing Canadian dollar and the fact that there were concessionary labor contracts made during the period when beef packers were extremely profitable in the first couple of years of BSE, that's now come back to haunt us. Cost of labor in Canadian packers is far higher than U.S. packers. And that's an uncompetitiveness. And plus, it's just difficult to compete against construction in the oil patch to get people working on the lines. That's reduced the ability to run a second shift. It's reduced the ability to run fast. There's empty places along butcher blocks and the fabrication lines in all plants. That's important, but that's also a transient problem. Far more important is the inability of Canadian beef processors today to generate the same value for the product that they produce as American packers are able to produce. The value differential is the driving factor why Canadian plants are running at something over 60% capacity while the U.S. is running far higher. And the reality is, it's because we are export dependent while the U.S. is largely not. You take an animal in Canada and process it, roughly speaking, two-thirds of its production will stay in Canada, a third of it will go to the United States. That same animal, taken to the United States and processed, at least 95% of the production will stay in the United States. Something in the area of 5% will be export. For the United States, export is optional. For Canada, export is an absolute requirement. The Canadian market will justify a slaughter rate of something over 2.5 million cattle per year, and that's it. If everything comes together just as best as it could possibly come together, maybe we could squeak out 2.8 million cattle processed in Canada and have that product sold in Canada. But that would be the best of the best. If the Canadian consumption of product went up and we pushed all of our competitors out, that's the top line. Anything over that is export. The reality is, when we sell to the United States today, we do so at historic discount levels. The election that just happened down in the United States was putting Democrats in charge of both the House and the Senate. Means it'll likely get a little worse. Because the Democrats are very focused on country of origin labeling. And that means Canadian beef sold to U.S. retail will likely come under much greater pressure than it is today. Our discounts are likely going to get higher. Pre-BSE, Canadian packers were able to extract fairly reasonable values out of the United States, much higher than today. But today, they don't have negotiating leverage. Without Japan, without Korea, without Taiwan, without mainland China, and with the restrictions that we face in Japan, U.S. and Canadian buyers know that Canadian packers have only two choices. Accept the prices they're offered or cut the kill. And in fact, we've done both. That's positioned us into being discount suppliers of both beef into the United States, because we don't have options to generate the value, and also discount suppliers of cattle to the United States, because we don't have domestic options for the majority of those animals. Being the backfill discount supplier to the United States is not an economic model that leads to prosperity, stability, and growth. Left unchanged, in a year or two, we will likely find ourselves in much the same position that the Canadian pork industry is in, where two of their largest players are exiting a fairly significant portion of their processing business. One has already made the announcements, Maple Leaf Foods. Only now in Quebec has brought in Lucien Bouchard, to help them through the process where they think they're going to downsize their plant, which is Quebec-based processing, pork processing company that also owns Fletcher's and Red Deer. They're looking at downsizing their workforce by 4,000 people. That means they're planning on decreasing pig processing in Canada. Pig producers know that that's going to mean two things. One, short-term financial losses greater than they've had today. And secondly, downsizing of the industry. Unless you can generate the value, unless you can decrease your dependence, you will not be competitive. You will be a backfill supplier. And it's not a great piece of news I'm delivering, but things have to change. We have to disrupt what's there today to bring that prosperity back in our industry. Brief recap of some of our key markets. I've referred to them, but where are we at? In Japan, we have access for beef derived from animals less than 21 months of age. Quite frankly, there is an overzealous optimism amongst many that we would have more cattle than we actually do who are age verified, and people didn't think through our normal production cycle. The reality is we are positioned in Japan as a permanent part-time supplier of lower quality product with higher costs. Not a good place to be. Permanent part-time because for 3 or 4 months a year, we're going to have virtually no cattle available for slaughter under 21 months of age. We're just coming into that right now. And during the remaining 8 to 9 months a year, most of our animals aren't going to be through the, will not be age verified and therefore not be eligible for Japan. When these very young animals come to slaughter, they don't have the marbling levels that are so needed in Japan. They're grading out at single A and double A primarily instead of triple A and prime. That's a major quality attribute looked for in Japan. These young animals just don't marble up as well as the older animals, and we have inconsistent supply. We're spot suppliers into a market that is short over 300,000 tons of beef, and we supplied them our peak month this year, 250 tons. That was the best we could do this year. If many more cattle are age verified next year, we'll do better. Let's say we double the amount of number of calves age verified next year as compared to this year. Instead of age verifying 1 million calves, age verify 2 million. That means we'll maybe get to 500, 600, 700 tons in our peak month next year, but we're still going to be absent from that market for 3 to 4 months. Our customers are frustrated. They love our product. They love the diversification. They love the negotiation leverage that Canada gives them against the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, but we're not a full-time partner for them, and that is frustrating. We have to look at ways of reestablishing trade to that market on a truly Canadian basis, not being too worried if it's exactly the same way that other countries are negotiating access. With access, we know that our sales to that market alone will approach $600 million in 10 years. Without access, we'll continue where we are today, which is very small. South Korea, second most important market in Asia. Our industry has set a goal to export over $200 million worth of product to that market within 10 years. We have no access. Korea has chosen to negotiate with the United States first to completion and then negotiate with Canada. They have a protocol between the U.S. and Korea, but it still needs a lot of work. The Koreans have negotiated a protocol with many restrictions designed in part to allow their market to close very easily. The United States industry is not happy with the deal cut by the government. Korea therefore is not negotiating with us until the remainder of the negotiations are finished with the United States, and Korea has been very clear because we've had more cases of BSE than the United States, and we've had between 4 and 6 cases born after our feed ban, which is our primary animal health intervention, that they will likely offer us more restrictive terms and conditions than the United States. And basically, they're saying that we have to give them animals of a younger age cutoff, 21 months, or only go with boneless beef under 21 months, provide BSE testing, and then they'll take more product, but something extra over top of the United States because they don't view us as being the same. Taiwan, the most profitable market for Canadian beef in the world. Our goal is to export over $100 million to that small country market in 10 years. Taiwan was set to reestablish trade earlier this year with both Canada and the United States. Our additional cases in January and later in the year saw that delayed. Canada threatened to take Taiwan to the WTO, captured their attention. We're now likely to see trade reestablished in January, February. We were set to establish trade in November, but Taiwanese authorities had deadlines by which we needed information to be delivered from our government to their government. We missed those deadlines by about 3 weeks, and that delayed us in their process of officials doing their risk assessment meetings, followed by their legislators, followed by their cabinet. We got out of rotation, and now we're looking at January, February. The information has been delivered, and if we don't diagnose any further cases of BSE between now and reestablishing trade with Taiwan in January, February, we will have access at the same basis as the United States. And that is important to us. It is a very valuable market, the highest value per kilo market for Canadian beef in the world, higher than the average sale price of product in Canada, higher than the value that we send to the United States or any other market. Hong Kong and its sister enclave next to it, Macau, have been a stellar example of what our industry can do if given reasonable access. Macau, because of a strong connection between the head of its government and Canada, he did his master's degree in McGill, met his wife, married her, went back, got Canadian citizenship. Other members of his family immigrated to Canada after he came first. Strong connection to this country. He went back to Macau. Was later appointed by mainland China to be head of the Macauan government. He had to relinquish his Canadian citizenship to get that job done. I think his passport is probably ready anytime he wants it to get it back, but he had to do that. When our BSC happened, Edmund Ho received two pieces of paper on his desk the same day. One was a order from his officials to close the market to Canadian beef, and the other was his invitation to go to Canada Day celebrations at the Canadian Consulate General in Hong Kong. He looked at both. He accepted the invitation to go to the Canada Day celebrations and told his officials that he wasn't prepared to close the market. Why? Because his family is here. It's the difference between some political motivated, this must be a big problem, oh, you're concerned, therefore I have to be concerned. What Edmund Ho knew is that his family every day of the year is eating Canadian beef with confidence. It does not represent food safety. And he told his officials, you're wrong, I know it's fine, I'm keeping it open, and he kept the market open. Hong Kong, because of cooperative efforts between our two governments, it's an example of our two governments working together well, reestablished trade for Canadian boneless beef under 30 months of age. We sold 20,000 metric tons, $100 million of beef, to those two markets in 2005. This year it'll be about $80 million of product to those two markets. Pre-BSE, we never got above about $6 million. We've changed the position of Canadian beef in those markets. Canadian beef is viewed at least at par, if not superior, and more a dedicated supply partner than the United States. Our product is in all the major retail outlets. It's in all the major independent restaurants and all the major hotels. Canadian beef is now accepted without question. The U.S. got access back. We dropped from 20,000 tons sales to 15,000 tons in sales, but really did preserve a major part of that market for us. Give us access and we will trade. Hong Kong and Macau show that that is the case. We really like those two markets. People's Republic of China, unfortunately, the Canadian government has got tied up into framework negotiations. It is a common negotiation tactic in mainland China, and we fell right into it. Yes, reestablishing trade for Canadian beef is important. But we as a developing nation in China, we're concerned if this kind of disease ever arrives in our country, we don't have the veterinary infrastructure to identify it and control it. So let's enter into a framework discussion where you'll help us build capacity, you'll provide aid on genetics, on production systems, and through all of that, eventually we'll be able to reestablish trade. Well, all of it's happened except trade. There's no timetable in mainland China. Mexico, last major market, tried to reestablish trade in Canadian beef as the first market in the world to do so. We're not allowed to do so by threats of the United States. U.S. said if Mexico imports, their BSE status will drop to that of Canada's, and Mexico will not be able to export live cattle, which they do about 1 to 1.5 million cattle a year, won't be able to export those live cattle to the United States. It will cause an economic crisis. It's an effective lever. Mexico is simply allowed to import from Canada exactly what the U.S. imports from us. It's a good market. There is future opportunity for us, but they are constrained. They simply can't do anything until the U.S. has already done it. So the Canada Beef Export Federation believes that the BSE crisis has been, of course, very harmful to us. It has made us focus on a more uniquely Canadian future where we have access. We need to position ourselves as the premium product in the premium industry and country that we are. We have to be much more vigorous in renegotiating market access. Our government must be much more vigorous in renegotiating market access. And harmonization, doing everything the way the United States does, when we are export dependent and they are not, has not served us well and will likely not serve us well going forward. Harmonization is a goal, but it cannot be a goal to the exclusion of our long-term economic well-being. Thank you.